So today is Worldwide Mental Health Day or some business like that. And I recorded a massive rant about Air Force suicide rates. And I really got going on this one. It's like 40 minutes long of my personal opinions on the Air Force and why the suicide rates are so high. I give a lot of cool data on there. I talk about a really neat article I read that kind of talks about some talking points there too, but these are just my opinions. So if you don't like them, I totally understand. I do think that if you listen to it objectively, you're going to search your heart and realize that I'm probably right about a whole lot of things. And there's going to be some information that maybe you didn't know before. So yeah, give it a listen. Thanks. Today is Worldwide Mental Health Day, and that means that today's subject is going to be kind of heavy. But, you know, that's what it is. That's the life we live. We, as veterans and as patriots, we are exposed to a whole bunch of things, both positive and negative. And mental health is one of those things that we have to talk about. We have to talk about it early. We have to talk about it often. It's not comfortable. Nobody wants to do it, but not talking about it does nobody justice. Today I'm going to talk about suicide. Straight up, there it is. That's what's happening. So if you want to tune out, cool. But I think if you stick through this with me, you'll come away with a little bit different insight onto some things. So here we go. I was sitting at work the other day and overheard a conversation between a couple of young female interns. I think they're in their 20s, early 20s. One of them said the words, quote, "I read on the news that we've lost more people in the Air Force to suicide than we have to combat," unquote. And that really got my wheels turning. It's not something you hear very often in the workplace, especially by, you know, young women who have no connection with the military. So that obviously struck a chord with them, for them to, one, even read that article at all, because I just assumed no one cared. And then, two, to bring that up at work as a topic of conversation. You know, and I wanted so badly to turn around and just have that talk. But it wasn't my place. It didn't involve me. I was totally eavesdropping, which is creepy, and I didn't want to go there. But I found that interesting because they used the words, "we've lost." And that was cool to me because that showed that, you know, they cared about the military. And the word "we" shows that they have some level of solidarity with us as the military members, which I thought was fantastic. So it got my wheels turning about why that is, that we've lost more people to suicide than we have to combat. So I did some research, and the research wasn't very flattering, at least from what I can tell so far. But I want to read you guys an article. This article is from NBC News, and I think it originated from Florida State University, the Military Suicide Research Center. I don't know if it's something I'm supposed to be reading, but I'm going to do it anyway because it's important. If they want to sue me, then they can sue me. It is what it is. This is written by Bill Briggs. He is the author. And it says, "Why Modern Soldiers Are More Susceptible to Suicide." The armed forces mourned a grim toll in 2012 when more troops took their own lives than died in combat. But a precarious question remains. Why is it the rate spiking with military life has been a suicidal deterrent? Among the services, the Army lost the most active duty members last year to suicide, 182. Inside that branch, as the war raged and waned, the annual suicide pace climbed. During 2001, 9 out of every 100,000 active duty soldiers killed themselves, while during 2011, the suicide rate was nearly 23 per 100,000, according to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Compare that sobering trend to conflicts and peacetime past. During the final 3 years of World War II, the Army's annual suicide rate did not bulge above 10 soldiers per 100,000. And during the Korean War in the early 1950s, that annual pace remained at about 11 soldiers per 100,000, according to a study published in 1985 by the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. Between 1975 and 1986, the Army's annual suicide rate of 13 per 100,000 soldiers, falling as low to 10 in the early 80s. According to a series of papers published in the Journal of Military Medicine, the Army's suicide rate in 2001 was less than half that for all American males, which was 18.2 per 100,000. Since then, the pace of harm among active duty troops has more than doubled, and that trend is not ebbing. In January, the Army classified another 33 deaths as, quote, potential suicides among active duty National Guard and Army Reserve soldiers, according to the Department of Defense. A once protective environment has moved to be something very different, said David Rudd, a co-founder of the scientific director of National Center for Veteran Studies based in the University of Utah. Quote, we need to look at the big picture to really understand what's going on today, but all we too often lose historical perspective, said Rudd, who testified before Congress on this issue last month. The Army's suicide pace between 1975 and 1985 should be viewed as the branch's, quote, baseline rate, he added. What has led modern soldiers to become twice as susceptible to suicide? The self-esteem generation. Some answers lie in present military lifestyles and in the multiple deployments of soldiers to Iraq and Afghanistan, but also in stark psychological distinction between today's 20-somethings and the mindset of past generations, according to Rudd and the veterans of recent past of U.S. combat actions. The fact is, nobody really wants to understand what it means to be at a wartime operational tempo for more than a decade. What that means for soldiers is, when they come home from those deployments, they never really come home. They get a block of leave for a month or so, and then get back for more, and then they're right back in the field training. Every time you're away from your family, that's a level of disconnection, and it's a big deal, Rudd added. In the military garrisons on home soil, some service members say sleep in private quarters versus the packed barracks of long ago have a difference. Rudd said that he was surprised to see that such a setup this year when he visited 29 Palms in Southern California. Quote, they had their own TVs, no common areas. Entitlement has grown in younger generations, and society has embraced that, giving in to entitlement, unquote, Rudd said. The military has made decisions in accommodating these kinds of requests for more privacy and more seclusion by isolating soldiers even further. Quote, this group is the self-esteem generation. My worry is that they have not dealt with enough challenges, enough disappointment in life, for many of them to build the kind of resilience that is foundational when you go to war, unquote, said Rudd. This has led to many of us having thin skin. This doesn't bode well when you go to war. But suicide is not solely a military phenomenon, said Cynthia O. Smith, a spokeswoman for the Department of Defense, who described suicide as, quote, a national public health problem, unquote, and the 10th leading cause of death for all Americans. The Pentagon has, however, rolled out numerous anti-suicide strategies during the past years, including 35% boost in the number of behavioral health care providers who work primarily in primary health clinics and who are embedded with frontline units. Suicide prevention is first and foremost a leadership responsibility. Leaders throughout the chain of command must actively promote constructive combat climate fosters a blah, 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 blah. I'm not reading that. That's stupid. They went through harder times, but such collective emotional strength that may be lacking today's warriors when compared to past generations who were perhaps better steeled for battle by the epic financial hardships they face at home, said Barry Hull, a retired commander and former F-18 pilot. Quote, stress is all about coping skills. World War II was just as difficult as war today, but think about what the World War II soldiers had to come through. The Depression. What creates better coping skills? Trauma, difficulty, adversity, Hull said. I'm not stereotyping individuals, I'm stereotyping populations. I'm not saying youngsters today are any less, but don't misunderstand me. Our lives tend to be a little less adverse. We typically do not develop the coping skills that some of the older generations did. So you take a young, patriotic guy, he goes over to Afghanistan and Iraq and sees things he can't even comprehend. And so, what does he do? He tends to feel the effects of stress more fully because he has not developed the coping skills that the older generation had. Unquote. One Iraq veteran who can speak intimately on the suicide epidemic is Andrew O'Brien, who was diagnosed with PTSD, and who knew a 19-year-old soldier with a wife and child back home who died in an explosion. That 2009 family tragedy left O'Brien asking, why couldn't that have been me? In 2010, after returning to his army base in Hawaii, O'Brien tried to kill himself by swallowing several bottles of pills, including sleeping medication and antidepressants. He awoke in a hospital the next day. Quote, the older generation, they went through harder times, the Depression, and they had so many worse things going on for them. I feel like it made them more prepared, said O'Brien, who has written an anti-suicide guide and who is scheduled to speak this weekend in New Orleans about his experiences. But among older and younger veterans, there is one common thread that perhaps leaves both groups vulnerable to post-war struggles, O'Brien said. It's a basic military tenet of Army teaching and military character. Quote, we are trained to be selfless. Being selfless is good. When you're deployed, you're constantly making sure you've got your buddy's back, O'Brien said. But when you come home, it's not good. And you have to live for the rest of your life with survivor guilt, with the fact that you lost that person. So that kind of gives a baseline about what some of the quote-unquote experts are talking about. And that's basically saying that Americans today are softer than they were in previous generations. And I somewhat agree, but I also have to take somewhat offense to that, obviously, me being a millennial and all. But it is true that, you know, my grandpa's time was different. They grew up in the Kansas Dust Bowl. They survived that. They went to World War II for 4 years. And they fought the Germans, and they fought the Italians, and then they fought the Japanese all over the place. My grandfather fought the Japanese in the Aleutian Islands, and then he went and invaded Italy, and then fought the Italians, then fought the Germans. And as hard as that would have been, we cannot get really tied up in an apples-to-apples comparison because it isn't an apples-to-apples comparison. Yes, my grandfather may have been more used to personal struggle than I am. Growing up in the Kansas Dust Bowl, he lived in Fort Scott, 1930s, lived through it, small farm, tough guy, before he ever entered the military. There's no doubt about it. You know, I give him that. Great. But you cannot just say that that makes you more or less susceptible to pressures you face in combat and thereafter. And you cannot also say that combat really is a defining characteristic of whether or not someone will commit suicide. Case in point, the conversation about the Air Force, right? We've lost more people to suicide than combat. Here's the thing about the Air Force, is the Air Force sees very little combat. Almost none. We have Air Force, you know, pilots who do aerial combat. Sure, they drop bombs on people. You know, that's a thing. We have drone operators and imagery analysts and mission controllers who see drone strikes on a daily basis. That's a thing. But it's a different scenario when you're there in person and you fear for your life. You know, it's hard to say that, yes, you've seen combat. It's like watching combat on TV. You know, you're so far removed from it that it's not quite the same. Yes, it's gory, and you may have, you know, certain feelings and guilt of taking a man's life. Sure, I get that. But you are removed from the physical fear of possibly staring down the barrel of your enemy's gun or being in an IED blast or things like that. It's different. It's just different. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying it's irrelevant. I'm not saying it doesn't apply. It's just different. So the other interesting thing is that when we'd go to, quote, combat as an Air Force person, right, we don't go in a unit. So the Marine Corps and the Army, they'll deploy divisions or brigades or battalions or companies. But in the Air Force, more often than not, you go by yourself. You are an individual augmentee. In the Navy, you may deploy with an entire ship. There may be 6,000 of you on an aircraft carrier or 500 of you on a smaller ship. You go as part of a ship or part of a group. The Air Force is kind of unique in the sense that when we go to war by ourselves. And this is a big problem because we don't have the camaraderie support network built into the system. So in the Army, if you deploy, you deploy with your unit. In the Marine Corps, with your unit. You may have served with these guys for 3 years already. You may have already been on multiple tours. You know these guys like the back of your hand. You know, these are your buddies. These are your guys. So when you go to war, you don't go to war to fight the enemy. You go to war just to save your buddy's life, you know, to look out for your buddies, your friends. Because the worst thing you can possibly do, the only thing that's worse than you getting killed, is watching your buddies get killed. Well, in the Air Force, it's not like that. One, because we're not combatants, right? So the camaraderie is built into the system of units that deploy in a combatant role. So infantry guys and all those guys who see combat and whose job is combat or direct support of combat troops, or even who just deploy together to forward locations. Camaraderie is built into the system. You know, we don't have to engineer it because it's already there. In the Air Force, you have to engineer camaraderie, and they do a terrible job at it. So in the Air Force, it's always forced fun. And there's birthday parties and cakes and these team building exercises. And I think it's because they know instinctively that they've got a big problem, because the whole entire system is set up around the individual. And that is doubly a problem this day and age. You know, that may have been fine 40 years ago. You know, and yeah, you're set up as an individual. You're still not having quite the camaraderie you did as people who were maybe in the Army, in the Marine Corps, or the Navy, but it wasn't that bad. But it's bad now, and here's why. And the reason it's bad now is because technology. So people are more socially isolated than they were 30 years ago, and cell phones are to blame. So like this article suggests, when he's talking about 29 Palms, even though that's a Marine Corps unit and they fight together and they train together, and when they're deployed they live together, when they're not deployed they go home to their individual barracks with their TVs and their cell phones and their computers and their internet. So they're streaming Netflix, they're playing video games, and they're socially isolated. Single occupancy living, double at best, is a major shift from what the military used to be. The military has always, prior to the last probably 25 years maybe, been a mass living scenario, right? So you are living in a dorm with a bunch of other guys, and it's been an open barracks. If it wasn't an open barracks, you may have had several roommates. But because the military has adapted to the culture, we're seeing the same problems that the culture has. The culture is bringing that to the military. The military has done a poor job of defending its traditions and withholding itself against what society is doing. And now we're seeing the price. So when these kids are not at work or doing work, the cell phones come out. When they leave work, they're not going to the bar and hanging out and doing all the things that, you know, previous generations might have done after work. They're going home to play video games, and they're going to watch Netflix, surf the internet, whatever. So there's no socialization other than the direct work hours, and there's probably not even socialization going on right then. So these guys are just living a life that is completely and totally isolated compared to generations before. And it's terrible. It's not a good way to do things. In my opinion, the best thing that you can do to stop suicide right now, or at least make a dent, ban cell phones. So you don't have a cell phone anymore. If you're in the military, you don't have a cell phone. That's just how it goes, you know? And people will be forced to go out and network and make real life connections. And they're not doing that right now. So when times get hard, and they will get hard if you're in the military, just like they always have and they always will, you don't have buddies to rely on anymore. It's you. It's solo. Combine that with the individual nature of the Air Force, and you've got a recipe for disaster. You don't have camaraderie because you don't have shared hardship, because everything is centered around the individual. It's you. It's how well do you look against your peers? How well do you stand out? Because you're going to have to go against them in competition in order to get promotions. And that's not a good way to do things. It's just not. I don't know what the right answer is, but the right answer is the opposite of that in some capacity, right? You need, how well do you contribute to the Air Force team? What are you doing to lift your buddies up? How good of a leader are you really? Not on paper, because you took some CDCs or you graduated NCO Academy. You know, are you demonstrating tangible leadership qualities? What do your peers say about you? Do they think you're a good leader? Are you lifting them up? Or are you just putting them through hell to make yourself look good so you can get promoted? Now, those are different things. You know, one of those is measurable and one of them isn't, you know? And the Air Force has got to restructure itself. The Air Force is dying and killing its own people. Especially since, you know, coming back to that combat thing, we don't really do combat. And combat is probably really intense and it's probably really hard. And that would explain a lot of PTSD and things like that, absolutely. But the Air Force doesn't do much of that at all. Not at all. And in, by the numbers, it's almost nothing compared to the, you know, the Army and the Marine Corps. And the other thing is that combat might not even matter. And here's why. Because there was a study done by the same group of people in a similar article that gives all kinds of interesting data. So it tracks suicide rates before, during, and after World War I, World War II, and Vietnam. And here's what they found out. Each one of those major conflicts, which was all bigger than Iraq and Afghanistan combined, each one of those major conflicts saw a decrease in suicide during the war period, with a decrease in suicide remaining for several years after the war ended. So suicide and combat are not necessarily linked. Suicide actually goes down during a war. And that's across the national level. Not just people who fight in it directly, but across the entire nation. And in the case of World War II, it was across the entire globe. Global suicide rates dropped during World War II and stayed lower than they were pre-war for several years after. And that was really interesting to me. So this, you know, this quote of, quote, we've lost more to suicide than combat, unquote, was it really interesting because people assume that people kill themselves because of things they've witnessed in combat, and the data does not support that. But the data does show that without a doubt, suicide rates have gone up. So World War II, they were 10 in 100,000, and that was actually a 15% drop in suicide compared to the pre-war suicide rates. And that is staggering. 15% reduction in suicides during a war. And then from there, it just kind of changes. And from there, Vietnam goes up a little higher. And then the post-war period of peace after Vietnam until 1986, it was up a little more still than what World War II was. It was around, I think, 13 or so in that post-war peace period. So still higher than World War II, which was really interesting. And you can analyze that a million different ways, but there is one common denominator with that, and it's moral clarity. So World War II overwhelmingly was, by everyone's standards, the crowning achievement of U.S. military power. It was a decisive victory against both the Japanese and the Germans. Without a doubt, we won that war, and everybody felt good about what they were doing. They felt good about the cause. They felt good about the mission. They felt good about the outcome. The same is not true about Vietnam. Almost nobody felt good about it at the time. And still to this day, it's kind of a black spot on American history. And nobody really feels overwhelmingly positive about Vietnam. There is no moral clarity to that conflict. And I think what we're seeing today is more of the same. Yes, 9/11 happened, and we're all really pissed about that, and we should be pissed about that. And special operations soldiers kicked the shit out of the Taliban in the first 10 months after 9/11, and that was fantastic. Great job. But the war continued still for 18 years, and people are getting kind of tired of it, I think. I think that's really what it is, because we don't see an exit strategy. It's ambiguous. There is no clear, defined enemy running around in jeeps and tanks that we can fight. It's a bunch of random people in a hillside or a village, and we don't know what their real reason for fighting us is. They're probably not Taliban, they're probably not Al-Qaeda, they're probably just pissed off for some reason and they want to fight us. Maybe they have some terrorist allegiances, who knows, but you know, they're not going to tell us. We can guess, we can infer it, but there's no moral clarity to this mission. And I think that young people are getting hip to this. And I think that it's not setting well with them. I think they're patriotic, they love this country, they want to defend this country, but when they see the reality of the mission, I think that there is a conflict. There's a term, and it's called moral injury. And by and large, I think that's what a lot of these guys are suffering from. It's not necessarily PTSD, because not everyone has that. But moral injury is when good people do bad things to other people and they feel conflicted about it. In my mind, in my opinion, and this is all just my opinion, in World War II, that wasn't an issue. The Nazis were bad. We knew the Nazis were bad, right? The Japanese were bad. We knew the Japanese were bad. You fight them, you kill them, good. Nobody is really morally confused about that. But now, because everything is ambiguous, that we don't really know necessarily, okay, was that guy Taliban? Was that guy Al-Qaeda? Was that guy just a poor farmer who maybe got paid by somebody to dig a hole and we caught him doing it, so therefore he's a bad guy? We don't know. And I think people are upset about that. I think that's one contributing factor into this. And the other thing is that when we compare to the World War II guys, you know, we see a lot more action than they did. It's true. The average soldier in World War II saw 40 days of combat a year. And in Vietnam, the average infantryman in the jungle saw 240 days of combat a year. 240 versus 40. It's staggering. So as much respect as we give the guys in World War II, and we love them to death, and we appreciate everything they did for us, and they're awesome, it's not fair to compare World War II combat to Vietnam combat to modern combat. It's different. It's just different. So yeah, maybe the World War II guys were tougher, but everybody has a breaking point, and it's only a matter of time before you find it. And at 40 days of combat a year, obviously was not that breaking point. And there were a lot of lulls in World War II. They might go months without fighting, and that's just not the case for us right now. I mean, when we go to war as combatants, you're not going to sit around for months in the desert. Not now. You know, you go there and you're going to be on patrol maybe every day, but surely you're probably going to do something once or twice a week at minimum. And if you're not doing that, then, you know, you're getting shelled by the enemy, you know, maybe in your FOB, or, you know, maybe on Camp Liberty or Bagram or whatever. But it's just different. The pace is 100 times what it was back then because of technology and because of the nature of modern warfare. And we're basically just wearing people thin is really what it is. 18 years of war. So if you enlisted in 2001, you know, because you saw the Twin Towers fall and you wanted to defend your country, awesome. I mean, how do you feel 18 years later? You know, your whole entire career, you've been at war with Afghanistan. How many deployments is that? It's an insane amount of deployments. You know, my grandpa was in World War II, 4 years. In 4 years, he saw, by the average, 40 days of combat per year, 4, 8, 12, 160 days, right? 160 days of combat. A standard rotation during the Iraq War was like 18 months, you know, 18 months of combat for a deployment. And in those 18 months, you probably saw way more action than my grandpa did in 4 years of fighting the Germans and the Japanese, you know. It's just, it's not a fair comparison. And so I take real issue when they say that we're not hard enough, because you got to be damn hard to put up with that. But everybody has a breaking point. And it doesn't matter how hard you really are. You're going to hit a wall. And we're hitting a wall. And specifically in the Air Force is leading the suicide rate right now because they're hitting that wall. Ops tempos are really high. They are focused on the wrong things. And in my opinion, if they fought in combat more, they would have less issues because a peacetime military eats itself alive. The CBDs, all the classes we have to take to keep ourselves from self-destructing as a unit, it's just insane. And they spend more time doing that stuff than they do on learning their jobs. And their jobs are all based off individual requirements. So they live a life that, one, is isolated, two, does not breed true camaraderie, and three, is so filled with bullshit on a daily basis that they're just throwing up their hands and they're saying, I can't do this shit anymore. What, I got 4 more years left of this? This is insane. It's a morality problem. Not a morality problem, but a morale problem. There is no morale in the Air Force. There is no camaraderie in the Air Force. The Air Force has a huge, huge problem. And they need to change some stuff, and they need to change it quick. What they need to do is they need to quit conducting themselves like a Fortune 500 company with their stupid military blues uniforms, their dress blues that look like business suits. They need to become a fighting force. They need to structure themselves around a mobile fighting force that gets rid of this individual augmentee stuff. They need to focus on squadron level deployments when it's time to go deploy. Okay, my whole squadron's going, but right now, one person from your squadron might go this year. One person might go next year. So you come back from a deployment, a changed person, trying to fit into your squadron that hasn't deployed in 5, 10, 15 years. You might have a commander who rotated in while you were on deployment and he's never been deployed. You might work with an old guy who has managed to skate by for the last 12 years without spending any time overseas because he's got some kind of medical thing. How do you relate to him? He doesn't understand you. You don't understand him. You guys have not been through the shared hardship together. You need to deploy together as a squadron, and you're going to find out who can, pull their weight. Who's a worker? Who's a lazy guy? In that way, you can weed those guys out. But right now, there's no mechanism because that lazy guy, that bum, that guy that skates by, the guy that doesn't do his job, the guy that doesn't pull his weight, but he looks good on paper, he has no real challenges to force him out. Or to recycle him, or to make him get hard, or to make him pull his weight, because he understands the political game. And that's all the Air Force is it's a political game. There is no real asking of these guys to perform their job under stressful conditions while in Iraq or Afghanistan. Not en masse, as individuals, sure, but not en masse. So let's see what that guy's really made out of. Let's deploy as a unit. Let's see if he's really tough. Let's see if that tech sergeant really has what it takes to be a leader. Let's see if that master sergeant has earned his stripes. We know he looks good on paper. Well, what's he going to do when shit hits the fan when we're over there in Iraq and we're trying to set up an airbase or whatever? It just doesn't happen in the Air Force, and people know it. Everybody knows it. I knew it when I was in for 12 years. It always chapped my ass that, especially when I got back from Iraq, because I was a little bit different person. And I come back to the same people that I've known for years who are just, they're dirtbags. And some of these guys have never deployed. And if they deployed, they went to Kuwait once, 10 years ago. That just, it's not the same. It doesn't count. We need to do it as a group. We need to build those bonds. So when things are hard, we have that relationship to rely on now. And we don't have that. Nobody in the Air Force has anybody to talk to. Well, they do, obviously, but they don't have battle buddies because they haven't seen battle. They might have buddies, but it's not the same level as somebody who's been through the ringer with you and has had your back. That's because that's not how we do it. That's not how it's structured. So that's the Air Force's real problem. they need to focus more on being a real military branch. They need to get out of this business mindset that they have, because it's a joke. If you want to be a business, be a business. If you want to be a military fighting force, do that. Take some cues from your other guys, you know, your veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq who served in the Army and the Marine Corps. Like, how are they structured? We need to start structuring ourselves just like that. And we need to do it quickly, because we cannot afford to keep losing people at the rate we're losing. It's not safe for the force. People are looking at it. It's not right. You know, we're not taking care of people, and we don't know how to take care of people because we're so bad at taking care of people, you know, and it's an epidemic, you know. And I talk to people that I've been with in the Air Force who are prior service Marines or prior service Army, like, they kind of just shake their head and laugh, because they know that, like, it's kind of a joke. You know, the things that we do and the way we do things is, it's silly. And I've never been in any other service. I've been in the Air Force, but, you know, I just shook my head and I was like, you got to be kidding me. You know, like, this fake fun camaraderie stuff. Like, if we just did our jobs together, we would be fine. And we wouldn't need all these little social events and the social engineering stuff that goes on. But, man, I know it's been a hell of a rant, but I just had to get this off my chest. You know, it's Mental Health Day, and, you know, that's what I'm doing right now. You know, this is what's wrong with the mental health in the Air Force, and probably going to piss a lot of people off with this. You know, that's okay. I know that there's going to be greater than 50% that agree with me in my analysis, in my opinions. I think everybody feels it, but, you know, the Air Force probably will never change, because guys like me, we get burned out and we leave and we move on with our lives. And the people who stay in are the people who are the political ones, and they're not going to rock the boat because that's not good for them politically. So unfortunately, I don't think anything's going to change with the Air Force, and suicide rate will continue to climb. And it doesn't have to be that way, but unfortunately, I think it will be that way, because of the political entity that is the Air Force cannot see the real problems, because they're not asking guys like me. They're asking squadron commanders, right? What's a squadron commander going to say? He's going to say, oh yeah, you know, I'm taking these measures to prevent suicide, and we've done this many hours of suicide prevention this year, and we've had this many stand downs. Like, so what? That doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean a damn thing. Not a thing. That's not how you keep people from killing themselves. You keep people from killing themselves by giving them something to live for, giving them something to be excited about, and then you keep them from killing themselves when they're having a bad time. Do they have a network of people who they love and trust and that they know support them? And in the Air Force, I think the answer to that is most often no, because the Air Force is not structured to support friendship and camaraderie in the way that a military force should. It is structured for camaraderie the way a Fortune 500 company would. You might have a good friend that you've met at your civilian job, maybe, right? But that's not going to be the same level of friendship that you've had while in the military, right? It's a different level. It's a different bond. And the Air Force cannot and does not foster those relationships. And this is why there is a mental health crisis in the Air Force right now. And I think it could change. I really do. But unfortunately, it's not going to anytime soon, because, you know, I'm not in charge. Anyway, I know I've been rambling, but that's how I feel about the Air Force right now, on Mental Health Day. And I hope you guys got something out of this. I think there's some really cool data I was able to lay out for you guys. I know it's kind of a mess of a show, but, you know, whatever. It is what it is. So thanks for listening. Hey, thanks for listening to the show. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have, be sure to subscribe, rate, review on iTunes, share it with your friends, and then visit the website at www.AmericanHeritagePodcast.com. You can watch the YouTube videos there. You can listen to the show. You can hit the merchandise tab and check out the t-shirts and hats and all that cool stuff. You can also find me on Facebook at American Heritage Podcast. I have a Facebook page there, so be sure to go on Facebook and like that. You can check me on Instagram. Once again, that's American Heritage Podcast on Instagram. If you want to talk to me, you can message me on Instagram. I'm there a lot. If you guys want to donate to the show, there's a tab at the very end of every show. That's the support tab, which will take you to Anchor, which runs off Stripe. Anything you donate to the show will be used to help the show grow and help me do the stuff I do for the homeless veterans at Passageways. I do a lot of material for them. I don't charge them a dime. I use my podcast as a way to get the word out about them because it's an organization that I'm passionate about. If you want to learn more about them, go to www.passagewaysltd.org and learn what they're doing to help homeless veterans. Thanks for listening.